Good morning. I am not Ted Maxwell. This is Matt Neely, and I'm joined by Greg Gerringer. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
And as Ted likes to say, and I have to in honor of Ted, I've got to do this. The engagement hour, a big part of our purpose, is to get you involved. We're a nation bound by shared values of freedoms, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and responsibilities. For some, that includes service to our country. For others, it's service to our community. It could be in various ways, shapes, or forms. And today I'm going to be doing my best to keep Ted's theme by welcoming Jesse Lugo to talk about his community service and stepping up to run for office. And author Ann Hillerman, we're going to be talking about her taking over her father's great series of mysteries involving the Navajo Tribal Police. But also, I think I want to get into how she and her father have worked to help give the Navajo a voice to the Navajo people. So that'll be coming up at 8 o'clock. So we'll see Jesse in about a half hour, 25 minutes. The Morning Voice is a unique show format with five hosts bringing their perspective on Tucson's top issues. Mondays is Rainmakers with Lydia Aranda. Yesterday, she and her guests dove into healthcare and community partnerships in rural southeastern Arizona. That was a lot of very interesting program. If you want to listen to it, the podcast is up. Today, Tuesday, is the Engagement Hour with Ted Maxwell. I'm here this week. Next week, you'll have Ben Bueller Garcia, and Ted's taken a well-deserved vacation. Wednesday, Food for Thought with Grant Kruger. And Thursday is Southern Arizona Attractions and Tourism with Tom Moulton. He's going to take us zip lining with Arizona Zip Line Adventure.
So he's going to zip line?
He's going to go first. Okay. Tom, you're going first.
I got to get video of that.
That's right. It's a good thing we're streaming live on Facebook. 10:30, The Voice is our page. And then he's also going to be visiting with the good folks at Casino del Sol. And then Friday, our executive producer, Dr. Ed Ackerley, with Business Success Stories, University of Arizona Wonder Stories. This week, Ed has a special Independence Day edition of The Morning Voice coming up. The Morning Voice, five hosts, a well-informed audience. And follow us on Facebook, YouTube. 10:30 The Voice is our page. Again, we're streaming in video right now on Facebook, 10:30 The Voice. Or you can listen along on your trusty AM radio. Well, Greg, there's one thing that I wanted to get to right out of the gate, and that is the mayor of the mayoral primary. I unplugged myself. You'd think I'd never done this. The mayoral primary in New York City. And
boy, it's been fun.
The interesting guy that won that one, among other things, rent control, that always works well. Government-run grocery stores. And what's the one that caught our attention,
Greg? I love it. The free bus.
Free bus.
The
service.
Free bus.
So any New Yorkers that want to know how free bus service, just, you know, it depends who you call in Tucson, because if you call City Hall, they're going to tell you it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's worked out perfectly, and there are no problems. Anybody else living in reality, hatchet attacks, you know, sexual assaults, actual aggravated assaults.
Public transport in New York City is bad enough.
Right.
That I mean, anyone riding it wants barriers.
Right. Turnstile.
The dregs of society in the tri-state area and in New York will still pay to ride. You allow anyone to ride?
Right.
Oh, dear God.
The only thing that New York's got on public transit that Tucson can't quite touch, graffiti on buses and subway cars. Tucson, and I don't want to give anybody ideas.
No, I will say this. They have cleaned that up from the way it was in the 70s.
Okay.
But part of that is they put a different coating so it doesn't stick to the subway
just
cars as well.
Just the paint off of it.
So it's not quite like it was. But you know what? It's actually been a long time since I've been in New York City. But
it's
still.
It's been 10 years, maybe.
More than 10 for me.
Maybe a dozen. Yeah. Maybe a dozen years. Something like that.
And I'm honestly not in a huge rush to get back there.
It's a great place to visit, and I always thought it would be nice. It would have been a nice place to live as a young person. You know, I think you're a lot more flexible.
You know,
in
late 70s,
what you want to immerse yourself in.
Even though it was dangerous there in the late 70s, kind of the energy of that city at the time that Saturday Night Live started. You know, the Billy Joel Scenes from an Italian Restaurant era. That whole mid to late 70s thing would have been cool in New York City. But I don't know. I mean, I spent a lot of time there between, say, 99 and 2006 or 2007. And in ways, a lot about the city had been sanitized by then.
Mm-hmm.
But the headaches of the city were still there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also it was very dark being there, like, in the era after 9/11. Like, I was there, you know, maybe 5 or 6 months later,
yeah.
and then a few months after that, and that did hang over that city for a long, long time.
It sure did.
And then, lo and behold, you know, 24 years pass, and things change in that city.
It's a wonderful place to visit. There's a lot of arts and culture there. Got to say, it's a great place to visit. But living there, you know, I think, I don't know about you, I like a garage. I like being able to drive places. I like a yard. I like a little space between me and my neighbors. And it's not so easy to get there.
Right? Well,
so I'd say if you're young, go there, get a lot of work experience all that New York has to offer, broaden your cultural palate.
But back to the subject at hand with this mayoral primary.
Yes.
One of the first things I think of when I think of New York City, this is what always comes to mind. Of course, you think about the uber wealthy, people who have more money than you could ever imagine, the power brokers. But see, I think about the hardworking schlubs, the guys, you know, the first responders on 9/11.
Train in from New Jersey.
Yeah, a lot of the people that are of Italian descent, that are working class, you know, guys that work construction, you know, and
construction, not construction with the air quotes. Yeah,
right. No, I mean, I'm seriously the working class people of that city.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, a lot of them are I'm sure very concerned with the direction that things have taken there.
Boy, oh boy.
And if you listen to our own James Golden and the Rush Hour
from 6 to 7 p.m., yes.
He is on WABC in New York. And a lot of his content from that show, you know, obviously that show airs on WABC and airs on our station as well. And you can tell just listening to James, like the mood in the city and the concerns that exist there. We perceive New York to be the city that's like 90% pure, hardcore left-wing liberal. And it's not really like that. A huge amount of people there are, you know, just blind, oblivious liberals that are like washed in their own narratives.
Sure.
But there's a good chunk of people, like I said, that are not like that. That maybe they might be a little left of center, but they're not hardcore.
Brooklyn, Queens, and up in the Bronx.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 And so, I mean, what's happening there with this and the rank voting? I mean, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Why does it even exist?
Tucson should really consider this. It would really take all this polarizing politics out. New York City, how about electing a bald communist? How about somebody just a naked, you know, just no pretensions, just an actual communist?
But just the idea of anyone that believes that the way this guy wants to run things will work.
Yeah.
I mean, this takes what we have here to an unimagined level.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm not saying what our situation in Tucson is perfect, but by comparison to that,
right?
Maybe we're not so bad off.
You imagine the prices of, you know, just, you know, dried beans or potatoes, how that would go up at a government-run grocery store. It boggles the mind. And, you know, well, you can come in next week for your loaf of bread. I mean, you can just imagine the scenarios.
The old command economy of the Soviet
Union.
You
want 17 varieties of Coca-Cola. You want your vanilla Coke. You want your coffee Coke. You want, you know, Coca-Cola with mesquite, you know, chips or whatever. No, you're going to get now the one flavor of Coca-Cola and now the one flavor of diet soda.
It reminds me of early 80s grocery store back in Kentucky and West Virginia out of Columbus called Cub Foods.
Cub Foods.
And they released their generic brand. Now, there's the store brand of things. You know, people still buy those.
Yeah.
If you go to Fry's, you know, and you need a canned vegetable, the Kroger, you know, carrots or whatever they'll do.
Yeah.
But I remember the generic ones that Cub Foods was selling were white labels with black product names. So it just said cola. That's the cola you're going to get.
So around 80 or 81, when that recession hit, remember all the stores had generic lines, right?
But this was as generic as white label with black lettering. So yeah, it's cola.
Like the signs on Batman, car, air conditioning vent, you know, all the
we have one cheese. That cheese, you're going to get that cheese. Only cheese. What kind of cheese? You don't need to know what kind of cheese.
June cheese. Take your cheese and leave.
You can have July cheese now.
No July cheese until July. So yeah, that's where we're at. So just seems a little spooky, seems a little scary. Look at what Trader Joe's comes into a market, and everybody's palates instantly expand, you know? So I'm just telling you, if there's competition, that's a good thing for you as a consumer. So New Yorkers, you got another bite at the apple in November. You got another bite at the apple, and it is this weird ranked choice voting, and we'll see what happens. But think twice before you pull that lever in the general election. That's all I can say. And if you're resting your case on free, no fare buses, no bueno, man, just trust us here in Tucson, you know, trust us. It's 7:15. You're listening to The Morning Voice, Matt Neely in for Ted Maxwell. We'll be back right after this. 19 minutes after 7 o'clock, coming in with little Joe Jackson. You can't get what you want until you know what you want. Thank you, Greg. So last week, this is Matt Neely. I'm sitting in for Ted Maxwell today. He's taking some well-deserved time off and having a little summer R&R. So good for you. Hope you're having fun wherever you are, Ted Maxwell. So I'm going through the latest goings on last week on Wednesday or so, and saw a memo from the Pima County Administrator Jan Lesher, and she reported to the Board of Supervisors how much Pima County spent so far FY 2024-25 on encampment cleanup costs. And in the memo, she said the county spent about $732,000. That's presumably through 10 or 11 months. The fiscal year runs July 1st. Happy fiscal new year, everybody. So it runs from July 1st to June 30th. So this was either data through May or maybe partial June data. So whatever it wasn't a full year's worth of data. But $732,000 to clean up homeless encampments. About $450,000 of that was from the Regional Flood Control District. But you had other departments spending money: the Conservation Land Resources, Department of Transportation Facilities Management, the Stadium District, the Keno Sports Complex, and the Regional Wastewater Reclamation Department. So you had a full slew of county departments spending money to clean up after these homeless encampments. One thing that I found of interest was that the year before it was about $400,000. So, potentially maybe not doubled, but nearly doubling in year over year in cost to clean up these encampments. Just thought that was interesting to note. Obviously, at these encampments, you have a lot of trash, a lot of drug residue, a lot of, unfortunately, people just don't have any sanitary facilities. So you've got, they're just turn their surroundings into a bathroom, and then trash and shopping carts and all the stuff that they pile up. And I thought it was newsworthy, so we reported it on the news here on Thursday. And boy, oh boy, Friday on the news on KOLD, I just thought, and they came out swinging. They came out swinging with a spin on this one. I thought was rather interesting. They said that nonprofits say costly cleanups are not the solution to homelessness in Pima County. Well, and they came forward, and they've got some stuff over at the Z Mansion where they have meals and kind of give them some sort of basic care and allow people to come and kind of get out of the heat, have something to eat, have a little fellowship, maybe help direct them to some services. So good for this group that does this, the Methodist Church pastor and the CCHS Foundation. So good for them. But the one thing that came out in the article, they said, they said that the county spending money is not getting more people off the street. Well, I would agree with that. They say, we do have somebody from the county, a gal named Darlin, said, we do have availability. However, we're finding that individuals are facing more complex challenges that are impeding their ability to access care or to access a shelter. Well, would that be, I don't know, drug abuse? You know, would that be serious mental health problems where they just can't get along with people? So I do agree with that. But here's the deal, Greg. Pima County, they had no problem spending or funneling $77 million in federal spending grants to house and process migrants from 2019. They sheltered nearly 500,000 people. It was $14.5 million bucks 2022 and 23. The city of Tucson admits that it spent, this is what they admit. They admit they spend between $10 and $15 million annually subsidizing bus fares so people don't have to pay. Pima County just approved spending $6 million for Kelly Ranch. Who's it going to benefit? It's open space. You know, meanwhile, any citizen who lives or works near the Rito River, near where our homeless encampment is, their lives are impacted every single day by these folks, okay? Every day. And all of a sudden, the county, you know, admits that they spent $750,000 or so, you know, and they all of a sudden a nonprofit comes, oh, we shouldn't be spending this money. $750 million in Pima County dollars, my friend, is that's a bargain. That's like nothing. So why should people in Jefferson Park or Heidrick Acres be forced to walk out their front door and see a naked person passed out on their lawn, right? What? There's a manhunt just up the street yesterday. We may be talking about that in a few minutes with Jesse. A guy who fatally shot somebody in over his truck. I think it's going to come out that this all started at or near 100 Acre Woods, the homeless encampment. I don't know, Greg. I just don't know. And all of a sudden, somebody spends less than $1 million, like $700,000, to clean up a problem. And all of a sudden, you got nonprofits. Oh, no, we got to let them be. Everything's fine. Well, I'm all for compassion. I'm all for people that also admit they have a problem and want to do something about it.
But so few want to admit they have a problem or do anything about it.
That's the thing about addiction, right? That's the thing about addiction. And between meth and fentanyl, and a lot of these folks are using both.
Well, you know what came to light, and I can't even remember where I saw this. It was one of the Facebook pages. There's a couple, you know, that people follow about the events in the city or whatever. And one of them was sharing a post about someone who was staying in one of the encampments. And they wanted to convey, they were ashamed of their own use or whatever. Yeah. But they're like, this isn't a fentanyl issue. This is a they'll take whatever they can find issue. They're literally anything they can find to get high for that 10 or 20 minute or 30 minute period,
yeah,
they're doing. It's not just the fentanyl. Of course, it's the meth, but it's a variety. I mean, it's huffing paint, for God's sake. You know, it's whatever they can do. Yeah. It is just an epidemic of misery. Yeah. Of our existence is so awful that we just need something to numb ourselves constantly.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to go away by itself. It is going to take something that we probably can't even imagine right now. That is how bad this is. And I sort of thought about this, that it's there's a creep of sorts. What I mean by that is, think to yourself, pre-pandemic, it's a hot summer day in 2019. That's the summer I started working here at Bustos Media and KBOI.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of coming down Golf Links, making that turn right before aviation. There was nothing going on over there. It was empty desert. There weren't any encampments.
It was a city park.
The DM same thing.
Had ceded that to the city, and the city was making a bike path out of it, and it was supposed to be something that people could use for recreation.
Yeah. And Santa Rita, you know, you might have had a few people. What you had drug users, and you had people that were mentally ill. You had the people, like you said, that cannot function in society. You had some people hitting you up for money. But it wasn't an epidemic. It was, I would say, 10% of what it is now. Maybe even less than 10%. But we sort of got used to accepting it. It got bad around the time the pandemic began. It continued to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And we sort of, like I said, we start to accept that that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other things that happens after a year of being in Marana, there's this little part of me, I know this sounds stupid, where I get a little nostalgic when we come down to Tucson on a Saturday or a Sunday and have lunch. You know, remembering when my son was younger or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then stuff happens here, and I'm reminded of what Tucson has become. And I kind of take for granted the fact that I don't have that outside my door in Marana. And I'm not saying that from a point of arrogance, like I'm up there lording over the poor people of Tucson. Anybody could make that choice, you know, to move. But I'm just saying the two worlds, how dramatically different they are. But it wasn't that long ago. It wasn't like that here.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
And the thing that I just, I don't see any change coming to the Pima County Board of Supervisors, especially after this last election. The city council of Tucson, there can be some changes a little bit, because you're going to have, at a minimum, you're going to have two new council candidates. You're going to, Ward 5 and Ward 6 are going to have new city council representatives. So that is a good thing. It does give us a chance to at least have an opportunity for dissent, at least an opportunity for opposing opinions on the city council dealing with matters such as this. It just seems like there's been this lockstep unanimity for the last several years, and it would be nice just to be able to have at least some discussion and debate of the issues, because these are serious issues, and they whatever we're doing is not working. We got to try something new. I guess that's the bottom line. We're going into the 7:30 news. I'm Matt Neely, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. Thank you, Greg Gehringer, for a couple of great segments. Right after the news, we're going to be talking with Jesse Lugo, who's running for city council in Ward 5. Stick around. Listen to some national news and some spots from our supporters. Support them. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Stuart. There we go. My man, Al Stewart. Saw him a few months ago at the Rialto. It was a great show. Always good to see Al on the border. Joining us today is Jesse Lugo, a local businessman and community advocate and community servant, I might add, founder of Lugo Charities, now running for a seat on Tucson City Council in Ward 5. Listeners to 1030 The Voice know you well, Jesse, from your work with Bike in a Box program, but he's also worked in the gas station business and later as an industry consultant and lobbyist, and all sorts of community service that you've listed here. Welcome, Jesse.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invite to talk to your listening audience.
It's always good to see you. Just hit that little silver knob there. You can turn you up. Okay. Yeah. And so, for those who don't know you yet, can you give us a quick overview of who you are and why you're running for city council?
Well, sure. I'm a native Tucsonan, born and raised here in Tucson. Grew up in Bayou Hollywood, which is just a west portion of Tucson, Arizona. And then in 1975, in fact, 2 years after high school, I bought my home in the Julia Keene neighborhood. So I've been there for 50 years. And so certainly the incident that happened there, I was at home at that time doing some paperwork on it. So I actually saw that chopper, and of course they apprehended the individual. But the reason why I'm running for city council in Ward 5, my good friend Richard Feenman is retiring in May. But prior to that, I would have regular meetings with Richard because he had appointed me to boards and commissions. So then I would call him then to go meet with him. But since he had a medical complications, I would call him and I'd go meet at his home, which I still do. And with that, back in January, he had mentioned to me that he was going to retire. He didn't want me to mention anything, and I didn't. So once he did submit that he's going to retire, and then I said, you know what, Richard, I'll consider running in your place, in your shoes. I said, all I need from you is please give me a list of your commitments to neighborhoods and business, and within 4 years, I will commit then to fulfill those commitments that you made to the people.
As a longtime business owner in Tucson, how's that shaped your view of the city's needs?
Well, being in the business for many years, owning a Lugo Speedway Chevron on Speedway and 6th Avenue, at the pinnacle of my business, in 1992, I had 21 employees. We're a 24-hour operation selling gasoline and automotive, truck, repair, RVs, and even boats. As I was one of Tucson's first fully certified master ASE technician. And what does that mean? That's certification based on text information, but hands-on, that you have experience in doing so. And so with my 21 employees, We had over $100,000 a month in automotive and truck repair, again, RVs and even boats. And so with that, it allowed me then to hire and retain young technicians, because I had the opportunity then to actually educate them on the insides of how to properly repair a car and do it right the first time, but also during that process. We always called our customers to make sure they got their estimate for the repairs. Normally they brought in the morning, and we had all the cars done by no later than 4:30 in the afternoon. So we had, you know, clients from the city of Tucson, Pima County, Pima College, University of Arizona, and of course the surrounding neighborhoods that patronized my business. So I started there working for Gil Huerta back in 1969 as a fuel transfer engineer.
Okay. Yeah. What would that translate to in modern parlance?
Well, the Joe Valdez, the former city manager, he was one of our customers, and of course from the university, from the city of Tucson, as city manager. Then he was hired as the business affairs at the university. And so my full service attendance, I said, Jesse, boy, these guys are organized. I said, well, I personally do the training. You greet the customer, second person checks underneath the hood. Third person does the tires.
Okay.
The fourth job is clean the windows, and the fifth is collection of the customers. I said, we're going to give them a title. These are not pump attendants. These are fuel transfer engineers.
There you go.
And so that's how, you know, that title came about. In fact, we serve many, many customers on a full service pump island, especially early in the morning. We'd serve them a cup of coffee, give them a copy of the paper. Normally it took no more than 10 minutes to take care of our customers.
And if you'd like to follow along, we're speaking with Jesse Lugo, running for Tucson City Council in Ward 5. Also, go to lugofortucson.com, lugofortucson.com. Jesse, I know a sliver of your community engagement. Okay, I know a sliver of your community. You just handed me, we could spend the rest of our time together talking about your list of things that you're involved with in the community. Obviously, listeners here know about Bike in a Box, which has put bicycles in tens of thousands, I'm sure, young Tucsonans over the years that maybe couldn't afford to, and also sure. has built family relationships with their parents or uncles or whatever, or aunts who have helped them put the bikes together.
Yes.
So we know a lot about that. Could you tell us about that and some of these other great things you've been involved with in Tucson over a long period of time?
Well, if people want to see about the history about Jesse Lugo, please go to lugofortucson.com, Tucson, FORTucson.com, and click on the link about Jesse, because it's pretty extensive. The first page gives you a summary. Then you click Learn More. It's going to give you 9 pages. It's backup information that my CPA, Michelle Bingham, during my service station, that she said, Jesse, you need to outline some of your history and what you've done for the community. Because after everything's not forever, and you may not no longer be in the service station business, but she was right. And so after the business closed in 1998, then I semi-retired. I was hired by Techco Ram and SCI Fuels out of Dallas and San Antonio, Texas, independent fuel sales associate. What does that mean? Supplying fuel for independent operators throughout not only Southern Arizona, but even portions of the western part of New Mexico. And so basically what my job was then to get the best price for our customers, then deliver the product to them. During a time frame, we were delivering 15 to 20 loads a day out of El Paso, Texas, to all these Southern Arizona towns, and been doing so. Some of the price, Matt, were anywhere between 15 or 20 cents less per gallon,
yeah,
net chip to the customer, rather than pulling out of Tucson. And so with that, a lot of my customers say, you know, Jesse, I'm making a lot of money. Well, yes, you are. But please don't ever tell our competitors where you're buying your fuel from. Because the company that I work for, we negotiated best pricing for you, and you're the recipient of that.
Yeah.
And the reason why, because some of our competitors may be buying the fuel from the same supplier, but they don't have the opportunity or ability to negotiate the best price.
They didn't have the other guys didn't have Jesse working for helping them out.
Well, when I was hired by Jim Whitledge, he was at El Paso, Texas, that's who I worked for. And when he hired me, Jesse, I said, what you got to do is wake up in the morning, I said, get in your vehicle, start knocking on doors.
Yeah.
And which I did. Now, I traveled every road in Arizona, whether it be asphalt or dirt, looking for independent gasoline operators to supply him with fuel. And so, in fact, this is the bag that I was given to by Techo Ram.
Uh-huh.
By pedaline, I said, look like a pedal, right?
Yeah.
But you went and knocked on people's business. In fact, Johnny up in Alfreda, first time I walked in his door, that's heading towards Douglas, I said, hi, Jesse Lewis. Jesse, I said, they said you died. Well, I've been resurrected. I'm here to help. And I tell you what, I just left them the information to fill out the application. Once they fill out the application, then we're able then to supply them with fuel from various suppliers on it. But leading back, I do want to say, because of the history I had with the service station dealers of Arizona, when I had my service station, then of course I was president for many terms because we didn't have term limits during that time.
Yeah.
But knowing that, I said, we better change the bylaws. If not, I'm going to be here forever. But I learned the techniques and how to present issues before the legislature in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple times, even in Washington, D.C., back when Senator DeConcini was in Congress, we ran a bill called Senate Bill 790. Under federal law, it would prohibit oil refiners from operating retail gas stations. And the reason why we did that as an organization, because we felt that the oil companies, and they were, putting pressure on dealers to economically evict them by raising the rent so high that they could not, they would have to walk away from their business. And so, unfortunately, there was a Daily Star article that said DeConcini versus Big Oil. With that, we introduced a bill in Arizona at the same time. In 1997, mid part of November, we ran a bill at the legislature. Brent Crozier, executive director, and I were there for 3 days without any sleep. We would get catnaps because at the end of the session, of course, we had to wait for an opportunity because if a bill had the opportunity to put a striker amendment. What a striker means, if it's transportation, we can then insert information into it, and that's what we were waiting for. And the bill was heard before Senator George Cunningham at that time. We were unsuccessful by being defeated by one vote, and that was by Senator Robin Shaw that reneged on her commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why today you only have one independent dealer left that has full service, and that's Mark Stradler on 5th and Craycroft. It's a Shell branded station.
Oh, it's, yeah.
In fact, I had the opportunity. I negotiated his supply contract for Mark quite some time ago with Shell because there were like 6-7 different suppliers. So they had to come before me, and I negotiated the best terms for him to make sure that he got the best price and also the benefits by branding with the Shell brand.
Well, we're getting ready to go to break. So just real quick, I want to do a rundown. 88 Crime Board, you've served as a board member on that. Boy Scouts, Easter Seal Society, DECA, the club, the high school club for business students, all sorts of neighborhood stuff. You served on advisory committees for various bond measures. Let's talk about the issues when we come back from the break. How's that, Jesse?
You bet.
Okay, you're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. 7:50, you're listening to The Morning Voice. Matt Neely in for Ted Maxwell. We're talking to Jesse Lugo, who's running for city council in Ward 5. Jesse, what are the top issues that are facing Tucson in your eyes?
It's not in my eyes. It's actually when I was circulating my petitions to get people to sign it. Number one was public safety.
Yeah.
Police, fire, transportation, neighborhood streets, and number three, water.
Okay.
Right? First one with first responders, police. You know, currently, as a public may or may not know, city only has 720 commissioned officers. Tucson is no longer the old Pueblo. It's metropolitan Tucson, and this is how mayor and council members should make decisions on it. And the reason why I say this is because the city of Tucson, based on the 552,000 residents, we should have at the minimum of 1,400 commissioned officers. and not community service officers, which they have quite a few of them, that actually puts them at a risk. So that's number one, because if you call 911 and you expect then either police or fire to come to your help, well, they may not occur. Some of the residents says, in fact, they don't even, if they have an incident around their neighborhood, they just make sure that they keep the doors locked. Some of the areas, they have dogs, because a lot of residents in Ward 5 don't have a ring bell to see who's knocking on their door. They got dogs to alert them that somebody's in the neighborhood that should not be there, right? So we have many, many individuals that I personally spoke to knocking on doors. Each and every day, I'd get on my bicycle, and I had a walking list, and I started knocking on doors, and I talked to many, many individuals that signed my petitions.
Yeah,
I personally circulated 321 signatures that I got by myself.
Yeah,
and we submitted over 550, but the city only then accepted 502. One of my other opponents, she only, on four petitions, only got 27 signatures. But she talks about walking the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Well, evidently you didn't walk too much, but the other individual, Elsner, also, I challenged his petition because he was 72 signatures that were invalid. Mm-hmm. I was not allowed then to present this because we filed with the Superior Courts on the challenge. Then, to my surprise, two city attorneys and one county attorney then challenged me because I, as a plaintiff or petitioner, could not serve the city of Tucson because they rubber stamped each document.
Yep.
In doing so, the Superior Court judge then ruled that under a state statute, I believe it was 16-351, it would clearly state that it had to be served by a sheriff or some other type of professional entity. But with that, I learned the process now that you can challenge somebody's petition.
Yeah.
But if you're going to be challenged legally, I said, if you're going to be challenged by the city of Tucson, I had 10 days to appeal. I just said, no, I'm not going to spend the funds from my campaign to fight City Hall. I'll wait for another day.
Yep. So what do you say on no fair bus service? Where are you on that issue, and what would you do on that?
Well, that particular program, in my opinion, came because of during the pandemic. So it's a post-issue where mayor and council members adopted that. But I met with some bus drivers on Easter Sunday. I met them at a restaurant. There were about 20 of them there. And they told me about their personal incidents and abuse by mostly the homeless people being abused, hit. Some of them were actually banned. I hate to say it, but actually they were peed on.
Yep.
And I heard the grievances about how SunTran, how the way they treated them.
Yep.
So I asked him, I said, give me the three bus routes that are the worst one. He gave me bus routes 16, 18, and 25.
Goodness.
I said, okay. I got on that bus, put my shorts on, shirt, and I got on that bus, and I got personal experience of what these bus drivers go through, but not only the public, the working class between 4 to 6 o'clock in the evening, traveling back home, but the majority of them had to cover their nose because of the smell from some of the individuals.
Oh, good Lord.
And so I wrote a report, and a couple of weeks later, I met with the SunTran drivers to give them a copy of my report. And so with that, today, there should not be no free bus fare.
Yeah.
Because if you need assistance to get on the bus, then in the past you had vouchers.
Right.
Whether government had you give you a voucher, if not, your employer may be able to assist you.
We're running out of time. Do you have an opinion on the data center? Excuse me. You have an opinion on the data center project that the county just approved. City of Tucson's going to vote to incorporate that area. Do you have any sort of insight or knowledge on that, or any sort of position on the issue that you'd like to talk about?
Not at all, because that document probably has a legal intergovernmental agreements that has to be reviewed. It's probably legal language that I would have to then be able to disseminate and, you know, make an opinion on it.
Okay. Well, we are wrapping up the voter registration deadline for this primary, July 7th. Is that right?
Well, the ballots are going to be mailed out on July the 9th.
So if you want to vote in the Ward 5, and the race is pretty much going to be decided in the Ward 5 primary, yes?
Winner take all.
Yeah.
I'm honored to be endorsed by Councilmember Richard Fimbres, Tucson Firefighters Association, and Tucson Police Department.
Early voting begins July 9th, Election Day, August 5th.
August 5th, that's
where correct. Can they find out more?
Go to LugoForTucson.com.
F-O-R. Lugo, F-O-R, Tucson.com. Jesse Lugo, best wishes to you on the campaign. Thanks for taking some time to be on The Morning Voice with us today. And keep us posted on what's going on.
I'll ask for your support. The Pio Su Apoyo.
All right.
Thank you.
And it is not Ted Maxwell. It's me, Matt Neely, and got Greg Gehringer behind the glass, keeping me on time and on target. That's for you, Ted. This is the Civic Engagement Hour. This is a big part of our purpose, is to get you involved. And this is what Ted says at the beginning of every hour. We're a nation bound by shared values of freedoms, liberty, and equality. And with that comes some rights and responsibilities. For some, that includes service to our country. For others, it's service to our community. It could be in various ways, shapes, and forms. And I'm really thrilled to be welcoming Ann Hillerman. Ann Hillerman joins us today. She's the best-selling author of the Leaphorn, Chi, and Manuelito Mysteries. The series is about Navajo tribal police investigating crimes in the Navajo Nation Four Corners area. The series was created by her father, Tony Hillerman. She's also an executive producer of the Dark Winds television series on AMC. Her latest novel, Shadow of the Solstice, is her 10th. In the Leaphorn, Chi, and Manuelito series of novels. Welcome, Ann Hillerman. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
We're thrilled to have you here. Ann, you had the privilege of continuing a treasured series, but because of its legacy and the depth and development of its character, of the characters involved, I'm sure there were incredible pressures to take over the series, from the beloved series, from your father. How did you decide? Why did you decide to continue your father's series?
You know, I had been reading those books ever since the first one came out in 1970, and I loved those stories, and I felt like those characters were part of my family. You know, I had basically grown up with them. So after Dad died, I went through a period of course, of missing my father, and then I thought, my goodness, I'm also going to be missing these characters. And I knew there was nothing I could do about missing my dad. You know, the time would just take care of that. But I had been a journalist for many years, and I'd written several nonfiction books. So I thought, well, and like I said, I knew the stories, I knew the characters. I had spent some time in the Navajo Nation, so I was a little bit familiar with the settings. And I thought, well, maybe I could try to write a novel and just see what happens. So I guess it was kind of a combination of grief and gumption that gave me the idea that I could switch from being a journalist and a nonfiction writer to continuing that wonderful series.
Well, and the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Your dad was a journalist too as well, yes?
That's right. That's right.
So you're...
when I was growing up, that was what he did until his first book came out when I was in college. But he'd been working on that book for a very long time. Yeah. So anyway, his love of journalism inspired me to be a reporter and an editor. And then when he switched to writing novels, I would often go to see him, of course, and I could just I really sensed his joy at his new career, and so I think seeing how happy that made him was another factor in me thinking maybe I could continue the Leaphorn, Chi series.
So, your biggest fears or pressures when you started, when you undertook this venture to continue the series, when we last spoke. Probably 10 years ago, you were writing your first, and now Shadow of the Solstice is your 10th. Is that right?
That's right.
So what pressures?
Amazing.
Yeah. So congratulations. What pressures or issues do you face now that you did not face before?
Well, I think the most pressure, as you indicated earlier, was for that first book. Because I knew that my dad had set such a high standard. I mean, he had been a New York Times bestseller. So I figured, you know, people would be curious when they saw the Hillerman name, and they would maybe pick up my book, you know, just out of curiosity. But I also knew, because Dad was such a fine storyteller, that they would not give me long to prove myself. So there was a lot of pressure with that first book. And really, you would think, you know, since my 10th book just came out, that that would be easier. But I think the only thing that's really easier is that now I understand that even when it's hard, and even when I seem to be running out of ideas, if I just stick with it, ultimately I can get something together that I will like and that the readers will like.
And I suppose, you know, your first book out, which was not the first book you ever wrote, but your first book in this series, continuing the series, it got you on the New York Times bestsellers list. You earned the best first novel from the Western Writers of America. So I assume that gave you some encouragement or feedback that you were at least on the right track. Yes.
Yes, it did for sure. My goal with that book was just to get it finished, really. And then when I got it finished and I got it published, and readers liked it and it won some awards, I thought maybe I made the right choice here. So then I wrote book number 2, and now, you know, book number 10 just came out in April. So yeah, it's been really exciting and wonderful to make a career change after already having a career that I loved, to be moving into something new. And you know, I think that's a lot of what happens to people in the West. I think we kind of get that inspiration to, you know, so we've done this and now we'll do something else. It really seems to me to be a land that's just full of opportunity.
Can't disagree with you on that. I'm on my second career now. It's turned into a bonus career, and it's very satisfying. So I think a lot of people can relate to what you just said. One of my favorite elements of reading a Hillerman novel, your dad's, yours, is the description of the location. For me, every time I pick up one of these and start thumbing through it and reading it, it's like I'm taking a little vacation in the Four Corners area. It's just beautiful. You both have a gift for describing the scenery. And I just don't, that part has not changed one bit, in my opinion. But how has the series evolved under your pen in other ways?
Well, when I had the idea that maybe I could write these books, I knew that I would never be Tony Hillerman. So I thought, I have to think of some way to keep the basic ground rules that my dad set intact, but at the same time to give it an update and give it a new twist. So it will be, you know, as they say, same, same, but different. So Dad had a minor character, a woman law enforcement officer named Bernadette Manuelito. And I always liked her. And I, a couple times, suggested to my father that maybe he could do something more with her. But he never did. And in the end, I was lucky that he hadn't, because that gave me the opportunity to use her as a way to kind of change the series a little bit and also to give it my own voice. So I think the Bernie Manuelito character was one thing that I did that was different from what my dad had done. And then because I was elevating that character, I needed to give her a backstory. Mm-hmm. So I gave her a little sister who is searching for herself, we'll say.
Darlene.
And then a mother who's full of good advice. And then I created some auxiliary characters. So I would say those were some of the changes that I made. And, you know, whenever you take basically a sure thing and make some changes, you always are, whoever does that is always wondering, did I do the right thing? But reader response has been very gratifying. Many readers, women readers and Navajo readers, have said to me how much they like the fact of that now there's a strong woman who's also solving crimes with the male characters who my dad created.
So you have gotten feedback from Navajo women and that she has resonated.
Yes, absolutely. Yay.
Well, that's...
And Anne, I wanted to jump in real quick. This is Greg Geringer. One thing that's interesting about the Manuelito character on the television show, I'm not sure about the story arc in the books and how it might have led to it. She leaves the reservation and goes to work for the Border Patrol, I believe, in season two of the television show. And what's crazy is we are right up the road from the address that was on the envelope. If you notice watching that show, when she gets the letter saying that she's gotten the job here in Tucson, it is the Swan address of the Border Patrol facility right up the road from us here at the radio station. So it's kind of interesting, comes full circle or whatever, that we're speaking with the writer who probably whose work led to that scene in the television show.
And you're not unfamiliar to Tucson, are you?
No, I love Tucson.
That's right.
I have a place in Tucson. It's the home of my heart. I have a house that looks out on the Rincons, and it's not convenient, but it's really, really lovely.
that's the price we pay to have an idealistic view, right?
Sometimes it takes
a little bit to get there. And we're going to take a break. Yeah. I got lots more to ask you about. It's 8:14. You're listening to The Morning Voice. And we're having a great conversation with Ann Hellerman, who's taken over but she's writing the Lee Pornchi and Manuelito Mysteries. We'll be right back on The Morning Voice. Hang with us, Ann. Looking forward to some more discussion. 19 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Matt Neely, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're having a great discussion with author Ann Hellerman of the Lee Pornchi and Manuelito series of mysteries, and fascinating, interesting, fun novels to read. I just enjoy them so much. Ann, welcome back. Our Tuesday theme on The Morning Voice is civic engagement. So in fitting with the theme, what I wanted to delve into is how you and your father have helped to give voice to Navajo people and issues facing them. A couple of quick examples. One was on the news this morning, I think it relates, but a couple of quick examples are the issue of the Navajo adoptions that was a central theme in The Lost Birds and your last novel. And then the issue of addiction treatment, which is in Shadow of the Solstice, which I think is highly related to something we had on the news about a huge Justice Department investigation and indictment, a series of indictments yesterday of rehab, sober living places. Seems like it fits, and that's been in the news quite a bit that we've covered here in Arizona over the last several months. How do you approach writing about Navajo culture with both accuracy and respect?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. You know, in the book that just came out, Shadow of the Solstice, normally, we were talking earlier about scenery, and normally when I'm starting a book, I like to take readers to some beautiful place on the Navajo Nation, and then I think, what would be a crime that would be appropriate for this scenery? It's kind of a weird way to think, but you know that's how we writers are. But anyway, with Shadow of the Solstice, I had been following that story about those fake sober living homes. I mean, what a terrific scandal. I mean, just atrocious. And the thing about it that really captured my interest and made me think perhaps it could be part of a book was the fact that the Navajo Nation, many Navajo people were involved in this scandal. And some of their relatives, you know, who lived, you know, in all kinds of towns on the reservation would go to the police and they would say, my son-in-law, my nephew, my wife's cousin, whatever, called us, you know, she was going to rehab, she was going to the Phoenix area, and then we never heard from her or him, and we're really worried. Yeah. And eventually the Navajo police set up something called Operation Rainbow Bridge, and they sent officers to the Phoenix area to find these people and bring them home.
Wow.
And I thought, I mean, that's just the kind of story that I love to make up. And in this case, I didn't even have to make it up because it was already a real story.
Right. And just in the news today, $14 billion scam. A lot of it involved these fake sober living homes. I think this is probably part of the whole thing, isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, those scammers would basically kidnap these people, promise to help them get sober, to help them get off of drugs. They would sign them up for, no matter where they were from, a lot of them were from New Mexico and Utah and other places, they would sign them up for Arizona driver's licenses, get them Medicaid benefits, and then basically steal their benefits. And yeah, just, if they complained, they'd give them more booze, or eventually, I mean, sometimes they just let them out on the street, or sometimes they didn't let them out, and the people had to escape. So anyway,
well, and they separated them from their phones too, right? So the people that were supposedly getting treatment couldn't call family and let them know what was up, right?
Right, exactly right. I mean, they were clever and devious. So anyway, that was one of the stories that inspired that book, based on true events and on the Navajo Nation. I'm going back a little bit. When my father died, he had a desk on which he'd written, probably his last 5 or 6 books. And it was a big desk. And I'm the oldest of 6 siblings, but none of us really had room in our homes for that. So we left it in the house where my mom and dad had lived. And the woman who bought that house loved it, and she kept it. But now she's remodeling, so she wanted to get rid of it. So the Navajo Nation, we contacted them, and they said, we would love to have this desk. So they sent some Navajo, they sent a couple trucks and some Navajo workers to come and pick it up, and we had breakfast burritos together, and it's going to be on display at the Navajo Museum in Window Rock. And I think all of that, I mean, it just kind of speaks to the affection that the Navajo people have for these stories.
That is amazing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was really honored when they said yes to that, and I know my dad would be delighted. So they're thinking of sometime in the future having an exhibit that talks about his work and my work, and maybe I would go and say a few words. So I hope, fingers crossed. There's so many other things in the works, but I think that would be really wonderful.
Well, I was going to ask you what kind of feedback or input you received from the Navajo people, but you already partially answered that question. I mean, how else? Yeah. What a higher sign of honor could you receive, or a higher sign of respect for them, just to say, we think so much of him that we would like this artifact where he penned some of these novels.
I know. I thought it was really, really wonderful to have it there. I'm sure Dad would be pleased. And I think it will introduce a lot of Navajo readers to his work. When I do talks, say in Farmington, which is on the edge of the Navajo Nation, the last one I did, I would say maybe a third of the people there were Navajos, and some of them had good questions, and I don't know, it makes me feel good to know that my work and my dad's work are, even though we're not Navajos, that they are recognized as being of value in terms of helping keep cultural elements alive, and just kind of speaking with pride about being Navajo.
Well, he grew up in Oklahoma, and if I read correctly, he lived with indigenous people, Native Americans there, and maybe that kind of helped shape his sensitivity and awareness and sensibility about the stories around him.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it helped him realize that we all have more in common than we have as differences, but also that some of those differences are really valuable and interesting and need to be respected. So, yeah, I was lucky to have grown up with a father who was so open-minded and so curious about everything. It really, I think, helped me become a writer too.
Well, we're getting close to 8:30. I want to talk a little bit about Dark Winds. There was a I think it was PBS did an adaptation of one of the stories many, many years ago. But now it's a full-fledged, successful, very popular television series on Netflix. What was your initial reaction when they approached you about doing this project called Dark Winds, which is on AMC? What was your initial reaction?
Oh, I thought it was wonderful. I was really, really delighted. My dad, that you mentioned the earlier explorations into turning his stories into something for television. Robert Redford was the power behind that. And I thought those movies were decent. I liked Wes Studi as Joe Leghorn, and Adam Beach played the Jim Chee character. But Redford himself wanted to do something that was truer to the whole indigenous spirit of dad's stories. So he and George R.R. Martin put together an idea that they could do something else. And then they asked me if they could also use the first four of my books in their new series. And I said, sure. And I, signed the contract and wished them well. And it took a while, but eventually they got this deal with AMC. And they are, I think, almost done now filming the fourth season, which will be on next year. So, and I've been really delighted at how many native people they have in the show and native writers they have working on the script.
It's really something.
And the locations.
Yes.
That's the important part too.
Exactly. It's wonderful to see. A lot of it they're filming in New Mexico, and some of it they're filming on the Navajo Nation. So yeah, it's great. It's very authentic.
The movie studio as well that's doing the work is composed of a lot of natives. I mean, it really is an
Yes.
operation that's probably more Native American than non-Native American. That's the amazing thing
That's
about
right.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I got to have a tour of it, and it's so interesting to be inside there. I mean, there's the jail, there's Joe Leghorn's house.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
We get to meet Emma too. I mean, it's just so many great things about the series. And thanks for your time today. The book is Shadow of the Solstice. You can learn more at annhillerman.com. And we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Let's do it again sometime, okay?
You betcha.
Ann Hillerman on The Morning Voice. We'll be right back after the bottom of the hour news break. And we have a little surprise for you in the last segment of the show, a little programming surprise for you. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, The Morning Voice. 8:34, you're listening to The Morning Voice, a little Van Halen by Triple G or 5G. You're 5G, aren't you? Yeah, you're 5G.
There's always that fifth G.
It's the fifth one that always confuses
It's
people.
like, my Gmail address has three G's right in the middle, and every time that I have to share that with a customer service rep for whatever reason,
melts their
they're
brains.
like, okay, now there's three G's in the middle. There's three. Yes, there's three.
With
Are you
you,
sure there's three G's? Yes, there's three G's in the middle.
With you, it's literally Gmail. I mean,
Exactly.
it's, if anybody qualifies for it to be called Gmail, it's you.
There you
A lot
go.
of
All
G's.
right.
So I was going through, that was a fantastic chat we had with Ann Hillerman, and it'll be up, the podcast will be up shortly if you happen to
And
miss
again,
it.
as you mentioned, I stress for everyone, the Darkwind show, which the first two seasons are on Netflix, you can
Sure.
get the newer seasons on Hulu or through, on demand with AMC.
Yeah.
There's such a great 70s sensibility
Yes.
about the detective aspect of it. It feels like a show that, because it's set in like 1970 or
Right,
71.
right. And just the detail, the cars and the El Camino, Cheese El Camino,
the production
and the
design.
early Suburbans or whatever those cars are that Leghorn that they have, and the cruisers, the sedans that they cruise around in. Absolutely.
And the thing that's so amazing for me is after my very first visit to the Navajo Reservation 2 years ago. That was the first time I'd ever been there, as long as I'd been in Arizona.
Yeah.
We were in Page, and one afternoon, we're like, let's go over to Monument Valley. And it changed the way I looked at everything. I came back, and that first season, I think, was up on Netflix. I
Wow.
started watching it right after visiting the reservation.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, I was really blessed with parents who were, my mom at community college took a class in American Indians of the Southwest, and it was a very formative class. My dad was always fascinated with Kachinas and bola ties, Indian art. So I was very blessed to have parents who were curious. And so in the early 70s, around the time the series is taking place, we did a lot of traveling. Navajo Nation, Hopi. We went to Second Mesa to meet a guy who made one of the kachinas my dad has. And we went to Mashongnavi, Second Mesa. We went to Canyon de Chelly. We went to Painted Desert. We went to the Thunderbird Lodge out towards Canyon de Chelly. So we went to a lot of these areas, and it was all because my parents had a great curiosity for this, a great respect for the culture of the various nations. And my sister and I were exposed to that from a very young age. And it, it's a gift that they gave me and my dad's interest in bola ties, many of which the good ones.
And see, I had none of that.
Americans.
I had none of that growing up because there was not a strong Native American presence in either West Virginia or Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. But you went to Four Corners and that spurred that curiosity.
It did. But you know what?
You go to Monument Valley and you see this spread out amongst you. And
but also has spurred that is just.
It gets into your consciousness.
In general, the indigenous people of the Americas as well, because that Mesoamerican history, that pre-Hispanic history in Mexico fascinates me.
Yeah.
The sites that I've been to there.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is it's still this hemisphere, and there were ties with those people to tribes here in, you know, what is now the United States as well.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a very fascinating world. And again, Dark Winds, I think, does a fantastic job. There's a lot about the Navajo Nation that is, you know, again, some amazing tribes across the country, but there's something really special about the Navajo Nation and then the Diné language as well, which is featured in the
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. And I just... I didn't want to turn it into a fanboy interview, so now we can talk about it. But I just love the fact that they weave elements of the culture, you know, into all the stories. It's not just a passing interest. It's somebody that's spent a lot of, has deep, cultivated deep relationships within the Navajo people. Somebody who respects what they're doing. A journalist who has taken a specific interest in it and is willing to report it with that level of authenticity and make it part of a story without seeming like it's forced.
There is, it does feel very, very natural.
Yes.
There is, not to give away any plot lines, but there is an incident that occurs in the second season near the end that affects the third season, obviously, and Leaphorn's wife, Emma, is imploring him for something he did, and she's basically saying, you know, your actions, what they've brought upon this house, and it's just, you know, their level of spirituality,
right?
You know, that it's like, it's so clear that if you're on the outside looking in, I think it might be easy to marginalize those beliefs if you put them through a Judeo-Christian filter. And not to get into the weeds on that, but it's just the way in which their long-held beliefs that could be centuries and centuries old still play a role in their life today.
You've got Leaphorn, who the character went to ASU, so he's got feet in both worlds.
Yes, that's right? Interesting,
and
too.
You tell during the novels where he's always struggling with that. Chi is very traditional. Bernie Manuelito is very traditional. And you see that in Dark Winds, it really comes up. Another thing in Dark Winds is she's like an undercover agent for the FBI, which is not part of the original series. I first started watching it, and I have not read the first few that Tony Hillerman did. I haven't read his real early ones, the ones he did in 1970. I think Blessing Way was the first one.
Well, it sounds to me like her work is what they approached for the first few seasons.
They did take some artistic license with the characters.
Because it has to, because certain aspects of novels never fully translate to television. You need that extra layer. The way a novel unfolds is dramatically different than the way an hour-long episode of television unfolds.
You bet.
But I think that I have not read the books. I know you have, but you feel the television show definitely captures the spirit of the original
books.
Without a doubt.
And to that point, I mean, you do have these issues where you do have cultures colliding. And so that is somewhere where it's very true to the series of novels. And it's obviously a big fan of it. So, but it was a pleasure having her on, and I think I'm going to suggest to Ted that he have her on again to discuss some things about her father that I think might interest Ted and might fit in with the civic engagement. So we got a few minutes. I went through this vacancy summary by Jan Lesher released to the Board of Supervisors. It's for the pay period ending June 28th. County business. So we're going to go back to the wonder of traveling the Southwest with Leaphorn and Chi to what's going on here in Pima County. It says that Pima County has 8,201 total positions, 1,104 of which are vacant. Currently, 13.5% vacancy rate, but it's not that statistic because any organization is going to have people coming in and out. But what really caught my eye were some of the details in this. First of all, the sheriff's department has a 12.3% vacancy rate. So that's a big, public safety is obviously a big issue going on right now. The other areas that I thought were kind of interesting were the juvenile court has 20.3% vacancy, and the justice court, superior court, I'm sorry, has 72 vacant positions. And this is, you know, where we're processing criminal cases.
Right. So right? This is why trials are taking forever to happen.
And the Pima County Attorney's Office. Get this, Greg, 76 vacant positions, 18%. And this is nearly one in five are vacant. And not only that, of the 76, 33 of them. So that's not quite half, but it's sniffing 50%. 33 of them have been vacant more than 240 days. That's 8 months for Greg.
Any idea what these positions are? Are these like paralegal type positions?
I don't know.
Support staff for the prosecutors or...
I don't know, but you just see, you know, plea deal after plea deal and, you know, oh, we've got to reduce the population in the prisons and all this stuff. And the people whose job it is, right, to help the sheriff, to help the sheriff's department, goes out, does their best with what they've got to stop the crime, to arrest those responsible for it. And then they get to the county attorney and courts, which are woefully understaffed. Another area... Oh, where was this one? Oh, well, the county's free library, 75 open positions. It's 14% vacancy rate, 27 positions greater than 240 days. Get this. Well, where are they funding the kids, the year round or the kids daycare from? Out of the library.
That's why the library is in many cases, the library opens at 10 a.m. and it closes by 4.
So they're severely understaffed. Well, that savings is going somewhere, right?
Right.
So that's where they're getting on. I mean, you've got 1,100 open positions. They're all 8,201 positions. They're all in the budget, Greg. Those are all budgeted positions.
And we know all of these are competitive pay.
And it's like, what are you guys doing with the money for all these vacant positions? Where is it going? That's their slush fund to deal with all this stuff.
Mismanaged somewhere.
To spend $6 million on Kelly Ranch and all this stuff. I know some of it's coming from grants. I do read that too. But, you know, the county's fronting, taking the risk, putting that on the thing. The other one that got my attention, and then we'll go to break, was, that's it, elections. The elections department, 142 positions, 30 of which are vacant. Greg, what's going on? What are we right in the middle of now? An election, the primary for the special election, CD6. What's coming up? We just talked about it with Jesse. What ballots are going out, and what's today, July 1st? Ballots are going out in 8 days for the city of Tucson primary election. There's a city of South Tucson special election. And elections is understaffed, 1 in 5, and the recorder's office. 426 positions, 126 vacant. 126. Again, we're in the middle of elections right now, a congressional special election and city elections.
Well, here's the amazing part. Okay, they have a massive media budget. I know the budget for Pima County I can't even speak.
Sure.
Pima County Communications, it's like $2 million a year.
Yeah. Okay,
how about doing some advertisements for these jobs?
Right.
We're in that business. So I mean, come to us. We can put some advertisements on for you.
The communications office, 31 positions, only 2 vacancies. So they're having
You've got all these other positions to fill. Why are you not doing a job fair?
Attractions and tourism, fully staffed. Good job, guys.
Okay, that's great.
And what was the other one? Oh, the economic development. They're 5 people. They're fully staffed.
I mean, those county jobs are good jobs, I bet you there are people that don't know those jobs are open. I'm serious.
You let people know that they're open. You
somebody gets a job with the county. I mean, I know people that work for the county that are like, you know, it's not the best job in the world, but it's the benefits are great.
Right.
So people want the jobs. Right. Let people know the jobs are open.
Don't tell the, there's an old adage, like, well, why tell the customers? You know, tell people what you're doing. Tell people your specials. Tell people that you got jobs to fill. They might apply.
There you go.
Who knows?
That's it.
You might be fully staffed. Oh, my gosh. We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, are we going to have a special announcement for the folks?
Yeah, we'll go ahead and do that announcement.
Let's do it.
Okay.
It's 847, 848. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. Wind Tucson coming up right around the corner, too.
And I was going to say, no significant slowing on your freeways. I was just jabbering on and on and on there.
That guy comes out of nowhere on me all the time.
It's just the way our automation system is set up. Things will trip if you talk too long. It's a good warning shut up. I could have gotten over
enough traffic.
I did not need to mention the silver alert thing because, again, what are you going to do about that? I hope that whatever individual is missing does get found, but I don't know how it affects traffic, so I should probably just ignore that thing.
That's okay.
Anyway.
We may help locate the guy. So
it's possible, so people can be on the lookout.
It's a good thing, and it is a fine, fine day. Tony Carey. Is it Tony? Yeah.
It is Tony
Carey. That's a great one. That's one of those great gems that comes out of the woodwork every once in a while. It's like, I remember that song.
And you know, in the video, and that song is now 41 years old. God. It's from 84. No. But it's got those mob connections. And not to go off on a tangent.
I did not know that.
It does.
Yeah.
But I have gone back now. I am halfway through season 3 of The Sopranos.
Okay.
I'm rewatching The Sopranos for the first time in 25 years.
Wow.
And you know what? I'd forgotten so many of the plot lines, but the main thing I'd forgotten is just how damn good that show was. And when the show came on, I was just about 31, 32 years old.
Yeah.
Watching it through the eyes of someone significantly older, I appreciate so much more of it.
You know what else is 41 years old?
What's that?
The PG-13 rating, introduced on this day in 1984.
Wow. I wonder what the first PG-13 was.
What a waste of a rate. It's got more swearing per minute than a PG film. That's crazy.
That's basically it. It's just some swear words or whatever.
In 1979, Sony introduced the Walkman. Happened on July 1st, 1979. Transformative device.
Definitely was. I had one of those in 1984 for sure.
Sure. I think we all did. Hey, Greg, we got a special announcement for the folks. Coming up on, I'm going to let you do it, July 12th, Saturday, July 12th. What's coming to KVOI 1030 The Voice?
A very popular show for those that are into tech. And I would say, I would probably call this the premiere tech radio.
Absolutely.
Show.
And it's
Kim Komando.
You'll go ahead and say it again.
Kim Komando.
Coming to 1030 The Voice. Isn't that awesome?
That is awesome.
Saturdays
from 1 to 4. That's right.
And so you can now your appointment radio window got a lot bigger because you're going to want to tune in at noon to hear Ben Bueller Garcia, an American warrior, and then that'll go right into Kim Komando, America's the digital goddess.
Goddess would actually be the way to describe
it. We're really excited that she wants to come over to The Voice. And it's you know, you think about a computer show and that's, you think about it, computers, but she's the whole digital thing, phones and not getting hacked and digital security.
And that's exactly, that's
identity.
What it's evolved into.
Oh my gosh.
Because she is on top of all the scams and things like that are happening and keeping your devices safe. And it gets worse and worse with that stuff.
And she's based in Arizona. So that's back to our local news and talk. It's an
our
Arizona thing. It's a great thing. And we're really excited. Kim Komando starting Saturday, July 12th. 1 to 4, right here on 1030 The Voice. It's going to be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that.
I am too, and that all happened while I was out of town. It's like I feel like all this happens when, and you know, you've like stepped up to this role as my number two, and it's made things a lot easier. It's like I need to get out of town more often, and more stuff will happen. Maybe I'll leave, and we'll get more shows that'll come over.
Well, who knows? Anyway, welcome, Kim Komando. We're looking for you to your debut, July 12th, right here on 1030 The Voice. Coming up next, it's Win Tucson with Kathleen Wynn. She's going to be speaking with J.L. Wittenbraker. We talked to Jesse Lugo today. She's going to be talking to J.L. Wittenbraker. She's running for Tucson City Council in Ward 3. Thank you so much to Jesse Lugo for coming in today. And special thanks to Ann Hillerman. That was so much fun. The podcast will be up real soon if you missed it. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll see you again tomorrow.